This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on Hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier, thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
Shouldn't you be at work?
When the seagulls follow the trawler, it's because they think sardines will be thrown into the sea.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
I'll have a low-fat pizza or something like that, or a few biscuits and some milk on a Sunday.
And you can pair up if you like, and you can fucking pick someone else to help you, and you can bring your fucking dinner.
Free kick on early, and it's through to Timothy Arnold, and he's gone and done it!
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Tony Hatton!
No!
Hello and welcome to Quickly Kevin, Will He Score? It's Series 11, Episode 4. I'm Chris Scott. Joining me, as always, Josh Widdicombe.
Hello.
And it's Return of the Mards. Michael Marden is back.
Hello.
How are we all?
All good.
Enjoying the series?
Good. So far, so good.
So far, so good. It could all go wrong at any point, as Newcastle found in 1996.
Here's a 90s deep cut memory that I just thought of then. Do you remember Mark Morrison, who sang Return of the Mac?
Yeah.
Do you know where he got done for community service?
And yeah, yeah.
I'm sure this is, do I remember this right? And he sent someone, he sent a lookalike to do it.
No, that's correct. That is correct.
Different times.
I was going to read this as one of the emails. But should we start before we even go into the post bag? Unplanned, do I remember this right?
Oh, yes, please.
Do I remember this right?
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 Okay, this is from Dwayne Dugan. Look, I've Googled this many times over the years. I'm pretty sure it's a slow, lingering brain hemorrhage. But before I submit myself to analysis, I want it to reach out and check. I remember reading, probably in Match magazine, that in the 90s, Michael Dewberry, I think, was unable to make a cup game for Chelsea. Didn't want to let the team down, so got his brother to go in disguise, and he played a blinder.
No.
That's just not true.
It's absolutely not true.
This was never in a magazine, was it?
If it's in a magazine, it's a joke. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless it's his twin brother who has a very high level of football competence but somehow has never been signed for a team, has got the same level of match fitness as a professional Premier League footballer.
And what's the disguise? Because the thing with Michael Dewberry is he had a shaved head and no facial hair. So his brother's either going to look like him or not. There's nothing Michael Dewberry didn't famously have glasses and a moustache that allowed him to land, you know what I mean? Like, maybe if it had been Carlos Valderrama, you think, okay, you could do a chance up to look a bit more like you and no one's going to question it because you can do the big hair and stuff. But Dewberry's the starting point. You're not able to transform into Dewberry using disguise.
Dewberry, in a 90s football game of Guess Who, Dewberry's an absolute nightmare card to pull.
Yeah, exactly. But what he is, you know, the iron filings game, Dewberry's the start before you put any iron filings on. So you can't disguise it. I'm going to throw that out here and now without even doing any research that I can't believe that's true.
I was just thinking, like, in a quantum leap scenario, just imagine that his brother looked exactly the same as him and could play football just as well as him. If you turn, like, even just the things you'd have to go through on the day, like meeting people, having conversations, I don't think an outsider could even do that.
If you were as good as and looked exactly like Michael Giubri, do you think you... Well, why is this guy not a footballer as well? If he played so well for Chelsea, you'd think they'd go at the end. Surprise, you got yourself a new player.
Yeah, you got two Dubries at the back.
Dubries?
The best centre-back pairing of all time, Dubry squared.
But, like, also, like, would his brother, having played so well, be willing to slip back into the shadows?
Yeah. Anonymity.
Yeah. You know the Prestige? Have you seen the Prestige?
Yeah.
No. So,
the plot, oh God, let me get this right, but it involves two identical twins who no one ever knows as identical twins, and they're magicians, and they use this to pull off incredible tricks. That's right, isn't it, Michael?
Yeah. Well, maybe exactly. Maybe this is it. Maybe there are two Dubries. Maybe. Has anyone, you know what someone should do? A deep dive into Michael Dubry's appearance record. Was there a period where he played 70 or 80 games in a row without missing a single minute? People were like, his stamina and his injury record is absolutely insane.
If you look back on Michael Dubry's career, and there's nights where he's played two different games in two different parts of the country.
Yeah. Or is there a point when Michael Dubry's gone up for a corner and then the ball's broken down the other end and you can't believe that Michael Dubry's back in defence already?
Yeah. I remember Alan Shearer saying once, God, it was like two different men were marking me. I just couldn't get an elbow in anywhere.
Everywhere I think, turned with Michael Dubry.
Like that scene at the end of The Matrix with Mr. Smith. It's just fucking Dubry's everywhere.
What do you think the most difficult bit to go through would be of your day if you're pretending to be, you've got the look and the skills? Is it talking to you? I think you could get away with talking to your teammates, couldn't you? Just say you're very nervous for this one or whatever.
Yeah,
but, maybe.
Would it be knowing where to go and what to do?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that's even what simple I thought. Stuff like where the changing rooms are.
Yeah. Like, he'd be wandering around Stamford Bridge, like that scene in Spinal Tap. They'd just be like, where the fuck is Dubry got? He's just downstairs in the cellar with the cleaners or something.
And you wouldn't know, like, when, you wouldn't really know what the warm up involved or when you came back into the dressing room, or you'd have to be kind of checking everyone to see what you did.
Pulling the manager for a chat before the game. Like, do I need to bring my own studs?
Yeah. Has he been there all week for, like, the training and the match prep? Does he know what system's being played? Does he know the names of all the team? His teammates?
Has he got the same voice as well? Like, are you having to adapt your voice?
I think we can safely say this is not do I remember this right. I've remembered this wrong.
Yeah, I've remembered this wrong. Okay, let's get on with the 90s o'clock news.
Headquarters of ITN, News at 10, with Chris Scull.
Top story this week, Lee Dixon denies climate change.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
And Jan Mulby throws shade on Peter Shilton. Top story this week. I don't know if... I think there could be a new feature we might need to introduce. And, you know, it's the kind of Lattice-style, do we need to cancel this 90s?
He's such a kind of... Of all the people, I wouldn't want it to be Dixon.
Well, I agree, but listen to this and tell me what you think. Hang on. So this is commentary from Manchester United versus Arsenal, and Lee Dixon on commentary. Listen to this.
This is a question I think I asked last year that you might know the answer of. You might not. It's all about why don't goalkeepers wear caps anymore?
Is there some change since the 70s?
Well, first of all, I said occasionally you do still see one, but not as many as you used to, I agree.
All goalies used to wear caps when it was sunny. And now we've got global warming, allegedly. And
maybe we've got taller stands since the 70s.
There you go. See, I knew you'd get a proper answer.
There you go. We've got global warming, allegedly.
I think that was him. I'm going to give Dixon the benefit of the doubt.
Are we giving Dixon
the benefit of the doubt? What was that on, by the way? What was that on?
It looked like
ESPN or something.
Fox. ESPN.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, if it's on Fox, maybe he's got to toe the party line of global warming.
He's making a pitch for a late night right wing talk show.
I don't think he's using it as a platform to say that global warming isn't happening. What do you believe?
It's tricky, isn't it? It's a very unfortunate slip, which I think might be slightly Freudian.
I think it's continued banter on his cap theory, that he's kind of saying that the caps thing disproves global warming. So I think he's continuing the banter. It's a good point about caps as well. It's exactly the kind of conversation we'd have.
Your takeaway from this is that Lee Dixon raises some very good points.
Do you buy the theory that the taller stands have stopped goalkeepers wearing caps?
It's a good question. Yeah, I don't know if I do buy that. It's not fashionable when a goalkeeper wears one. I always think it's a sign of weakness.
Do you?
But you get a foreign goalkeeper wearing tracksuit bottoms. It's like, you're not cut out for this.
Yeah, yeah, the Stuart Pearce theory.
You can't handle this.
I would like Dixon to clip. I'm presuming you weren't watching Arsenal v Man U on ESPN.
No, I just saw people talking.
So people are talking about it. So I hope Dixon's going to come out and clarify his comments. That would be my hope.
I could text him and ask, but I just think I don't want to find out. Let's just give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, let's just give him the benefit of the doubt before he's doing a Q&A with Matt Letizia on Getter or whatever it's called. Okay, tell us, Chris, about Peter Shilton. And, Shilton, that's what we're in it for, isn't it?
Well, look, Jan Molby, thank you to Steve Davies who pointed this out to me. Jan Molby's done an interview recently talking about Peter Shilton, talking about penalties. This is a quote from Jan Molby.
Oh, Jan Molby was an excellent penalty taker.
Excellent penalty taker. They're asking him about taking penalties.
He was the Letizia of his day.
It's interesting because Jan Molby actually is talking up Peter Shilton's penalty saving abilities. Jan Molby says this: it wasn't always that straightforward, of course, taking penalties. Peter Shilton, for example, never used to move before the kick was taken. So you could never send him the wrong way as a result. But he would always usually start his dive when I was running back to the central circle for a restart.
So say that.
That's a direct quote from Peter Shilton.
Lovely.
Direct quote from Jan Molby.
I love that.
Absolutely brilliant.
But it's interesting that he kind of talks up the tactics a bit. You can't send him the wrong way because he's gonna go the right way.
But this is the inherent problem. I can't believe we're back on this. that there is something inherently, you know, an inherent victory or positive about having gone the right way, as if it matters. It doesn't matter if you went the right way, but it went in. It makes no difference.
There we go.
Is that going to be the last mention of it? We will see. Should we move on to the electronic postbag?
Let's do it.
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the electronic postbag.
You've got mail.
Would you like a quick Strange Hill from Graham Buckle?
Please.
Glad you brought up the dubious goals panel, as it raised a wry smile on my face as I was listening. Surely I cannot be the only person who thought the below. For years, I mistakenly thought the word dubious had been chosen by the media to describe the goals panel and its credibility, honesty and integrity and lack thereof.
The sinister goals panel.
I often thought it was such a bizarre coincidence that every newspaper TV channel consistently used the same adjective to describe the goals panel. Never dodgy or suspicious, only ever dubious. Inexplicably, it never occurred to me that the review was for dubious goals. Instead thinking, oh yeah, there's dubious characters on the goals panel. Well, no, chalk off that Yakubu goal. That's past some kind of sinister art.
Okay, here's my dubious goal.
Years later, in my mid-20s, my friend informed me of my mistake, laughing as he did so. Thanks for bringing back the memories. Keep up the good work. Cheers, Graham.
Should we cast the dubious goals panel? I'll go first. Dave Courtney, the old gangster.
The old gangster. Well, Hans Sagers would be part of the dubious goals panel, wouldn't he?
I'll grovel
and be a shoo-in for the dubious goals panel. It is odd. Dubious is such a weird word in the context, isn't it? Like, it does draw attention to the fact why have they used the word dubious, which is so rarely used?
I can't think of a time like in my life I've ever used the word.
Contentious.
Yeah.
Disputed.
Yeah. But dubious, you very rarely use that.
Never use it outside of the context of this.
But there we go. That is, it is good to have Strange Hill back. Now, this is a feature I would call I Can't Believe This Happened After the 90s. This is from Sean Spinetto. Hi, chaps. Late to the podcast, but working my way through and loving it. On hearing the piece about weird program content on a recent podcast, it jogged my memory to an article in the Grimsby Town program when I visited with Derby. It was in 2003, but I hope you agree it deserves dispensation for being non-90s. I attached the article and will allow you to decipher your favourite Carry On S lines. So what this is a column in the Grimsby program, and this is why you won't believe this is after the 90s. It's called Mandy Is Up For It, Are You? And it's a picture of an attractive model in a bikini. But the bikini has Grimsby Town logos on it. And then the column is written as a string of innuendos by a sex-hungry woman about the Grimsby Town activity.
Jesus.
So this is a column called Coming From Behind by Mandy Mariner. My new feature proved popular last Tuesday. I don't think I've ever gone down so well before. Well, maybe once or twice. God. But people seem to enjoy a look back at one of those moments when all the huffing and puffing proves worth it as you come from behind and let out a huge sigh of satisfaction at your efforts. Today's match is from the season 1997-98, an epic season. Remember the Rumbelows Cup and the Holders Leicester City? Here at Blundell Park, and 1-0 up at half-time in the third round tie. Then the Mariners came strongly in the second 45 minutes and victory was ours. Kevin Jobling was on as a sub, helping to change the game. Blow-by-blow jobbers walked down the Foxes. And then Livo moved in for the kill. It's fair to say that the big man did not know too much about one of the goals. I think it hit him in the backside. But hey, if it gets you where you want to go, then don't be afraid to use your backside. That's something I've always believed in. What a victory. What a climax. I don't think I've experienced many like that before or since. Well, maybe one or two. Isn't that an astonishing thing to appear in the Grimsby Town programme?
God!
I can't believe that exists. In 2003, in the official match day programme.
That is the kind of thing that... I don't think I've ever read a porn magazine, but that's what I imagine the content is like the interviews.
Yeah, exactly. I can't believe that's happened. I simply can't believe it's happened.
Can you just get away with that in the lower leagues? Is that the thing?
You can't. What? Writing softcore pornography in your match day programme? Bizarre.
Do you think it's the case that they hired the programme editor at Grimsby from like Fiesta? Or something like that. And he's like, I know something that goes down well.
Maybe I'll text Lloyd Griffith and ask if he's got any info on this and we'll tell you about it next week. Okay, if you want to get in touch, this is how.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin. And sign up to the mailing list @quicklykevin.com.
Before our main interview, if you would like to join the Quickly Kevin fan club, head over to anotherslice.com/quicklykevin. There you can get extended versions of all our episodes. Episodes are up 7 days early. You have your opportunity to ask your own questions to the guests. Plus, there's two extra episodes a month, one with Ivo Graham joining us to work our way through the Steve Bruce books, and another extra special episode each month. And an extra long version of this interview. Plus, next week's episode is available for you there, waiting now, and it is with the amazing Dion Dublin, waiting there for you. On with this episode. It is a great episode. I've absolutely loved this. If you enjoyed Mandy Mariner, you're going to enjoy this episode. James Brown was the editor of Loaded in the 90s. He's also a big Leeds United fan. This is about how football took over the publishing industry in the 90s. This is James Brown.
Today's guest is a Leeds fan, but more importantly, he is one of Britain's most important cultural figures of the best decade of all, the 90s. After working for the NME, he was the man who came up with Loaded Magazine, revolutionising the publishing industry and playing a huge role in making football cool. Please welcome James Brown.
Hello. How are you doing, James? Thank you.
You agree with that summation?
I don't think I made football cool, but it's very nice to hear all of that other stuff. I think what we did about football was we interviewed footballers in a way that fans would like to interview them.
Yeah.
So football interviews were back page of newspapers, and they'd have a novelty photograph. If a new striker signed, they'd have a cowboy hat and some six guns. And it was all very kind of Butlins, you know, the way it was dealt with. And so we just started writing about them at length in much the same way my mates and I have been writing about music at the NME.
Yeah.
And they seemed to like it, you know, because they knew we wouldn't stitch them up. So they opened up a bit more.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
We'll come to so many footballers you talk to, but firstly, I've just read your brilliant memoir, Animal House, which is incredible. I'd say it's just so many great anecdotes.
You're the first person to read.
Am I? Oh, yeah. Wow. You grew up, you say, it says next door as a Leeds fan to Alan Clark.
Yeah, opposite.
That's an incredible kind of thing to have as a kid. What was that like as a kid? Did you see much of him?
Loads. My mum and his wife were friends. So I have memories of him coming back from the 1970 World Cup and unpacking his bag.
Oh, wow.
And also, just I can remember being in his house and watching the TV, looking for the results. And they were playing away at Reading, possibly, and me pronouncing it as Reading. And also putting his actual England caps on. I don't know if they get them anymore, but...
Yeah.
Used to
with
get
a little kind of tassel and stuff.
Yeah, like a felt blue with kind of piping on it. I can remember he had them in a cabinet and putting them on, and it was great. His dog was called Pelé.
Oh, of course it was.
Did you ever play football with him? You must have had the opportunity. Did you ever go in the garden and kick it about?
I was always going and knocking on the door and asking him if he'd play. I was a really little kid, you know, so 5, 6, and, he didn't mind me coming in and out of the house with my mum, but I don't think he fancied a kick around. maybe he thought I might get injured or something. What it made me think, I guess, was when I wrote my book, I think maybe that gave me the idea that anything was possible.
Yeah.
And that kind of famous people were real, not just something that appeared in a magazine or on the television.
Yeah, because I suppose Alan Clark, to you as a six-year-old, like, would have been as untouchable if he hadn't lived across the road as, say, Gazza was to me when I was six or whatever.
Yeah, totally.
Did you see? Were there other Leeds players that would come and go? Like, was he?
I was born in London. We moved back to just outside Leeds, and we lived in this quite posh place for a couple of years before I moved into Headingley. And it's the place where footballers still live. It's just outside Leeds. It's quite near where Leeds United train in Thorpe Arch, which is just outside Wetherby. So, you know, you used to see Paul Reaney. His wife was the hairdresser. I mean, they weren't walking up and down the road, arm in arm, singing. Really, it was, you know, I mean, I'm sure if you go over to those places now, you'd bump. Well, people did all the time with Bielsa. They bumped into him and got a picture all the time. And
yeah. As a teenager, you get into writing fanzines and, but obviously, music. Did you consider doing a Leeds fanzine? Like, because you're a big Leeds United fan.
No, I mean, there weren't any football fanzines in the, you know, in the kind of mid-70s, apart from one called Foul, I think, which a guy called Stan Hay did. And that was an irreverent, I think he described it as being like Private Eye for football or something like that. And no, I mean, the first fanzines that came out for football were kind of post the music fanzine boom that I was part of. And so when Saturday comes, and I wish I could, maybe it was off the ball, of course, maybe it was off the ball, but they both looked like the end. And they came out, I guess, at the end of the 80s or the early 90s. And then there was a boom in football fanzines. Yeah. They all looked just like our music fanzines from, you know, the mid 80s, which have turned largely looked like the punk fanzines from the end of the 70s, like 48 Thrills and Sniffing Glue and things.
I'm really interested in how music culture influenced what you did with football. And you were working at NME in the early 90s, spending a lot of time with bands. So how often is football coming up in your conversations with different bands? And
you're spot on. I mean, it got to a point in the early 90s where, I don't know if it was because everybody was in competition in a way, as well as being collective fans. But if you went to the Reading Festival in, say, 1991, and you were stood backstage, the conversation, everyone would be stood around in blue kind of zip-up fleeces. You know, the kind of like, there was a festival look. Everyone wore fleeces. And people were just, especially all the A&R men and the record business people, they just talked about football. I think after 1990, and then the start of the Premier League or the Premiership, whatever it was called then, it just became much more visible.
Yeah.
You know, it really, as a kid, you never saw football.
Yeah.
That's why we played it so much. You never saw it. You'd see the FA Cup and you'd see the home internationals, which were great, which was just before the start of the season. Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, England would all play each other, often fighting on the pitch for the between guys who played for the same teams. And then some of the World Cup, you know. I remember watching the Leeds players in 74, like Bremner and Jordan and so on, playing in that World Cup. I mean, it's so long ago now, but it's just, it's as with the accessibility to music. We could listen to anything possibly that we wanted to now. So you were just starved, which is also why you mentioned Shoot earlier. It's why things like that were so important to fans, because... Yeah. And most of us, you know, my son collects the stickers, you know, but it's all on YouTube for him now. He's watching people analysing different teams and FIFA and all of that. But most of our access to football was in the packs of cards with bubble gum in them.
Yeah.
And the bubble gum was like brittle blue tack. It was like, you know, you put it in your mouth, you probably cut the top of it. You got these great cards, and it's just exactly the same thing as they get now with cards and stickers. But that was it.
Yeah.
There was nothing else. I mean, you didn't read a newspaper as a kid. You know, I guess Football Focus was probably on, but there was no, you were just starved of it. So things became kind of, players seemed even more legendary.
Yeah.
And you get these names like from the 70s, I mean, we want to talk about the 90s, but the 70s, like Breitner and Cruyff and Naiskin.
Yeah.
You know, you'd probably see one or two games of them in the World Cup. And of course, England didn't qualify in 74 or 78. So throughout the whole of the 70s, we're essentially watching Scotland. And Scotland were mainly made up of Leeds Man United, Liverpool, Rangers and Celtic fans, maybe the odd Aberdeen player in the late 70s. And so that was it, you know, that was the access to football. And Match of the Day was on, like, you know, after Starsky and Hutch or whatever was on, whatever the drama was on after the two Ronnies, you didn't see it.
By the even at the Italian 90 World Cup, it still felt like that was it was probably the last World Cup where it felt like there was just players and teams you'd never heard of. Do you know what I mean? I know I was young or whatever. That was coming to the end of that. In your book, you say you interviewed Marquis Smith and he had Panini stickers on his wall.
Yeah, on his map. So Mark Smith on the fall. I mean, he wrote Kicker Conspiracy about football hooligans, which was a good... I think they filmed that at Bury Football Club or somewhere like that, the video. And I knew Mark quite well after I'd interviewed him a few times. I was at his house. The first time I went to his house, he had a map on the wall in a sort of little study area or the back room. Yeah. And he just had two Man City players there stuck on.
Do you think someone had given him the stickers? He's not going out and buying the packets, right?
I've no idea how he would have sussed.
I can't imagine Marquis.
Actually, that's a great question. I don't know. I'll ask his ex-wife when I see him.
Was he as... I mean, this isn't football. Was he as difficult and caustic? No.
He was really nice. He was like... Was he? If Mark liked you, you know, he was nice. He was friendly. And he was also very polite to... people who would be, you know, like cab drivers or waiters, or he was, you know, he would often ask about my mum who was ill. And, you know, if you were his mate and he liked you, then he was good. But I think if you're in the band, it was quite hard going. And, you know, I think it was great company, you know, it was brilliant company.
In your book, you discuss a charity gig, which you say was the first time you noticed football and music. I think it was 92, you said football and music come together. And
the new CND or the anti-nuclear power. Yeah.
So what was that that made you think this is a thing where they're...
It was an amazing lineup. It was U2 when they were really good, when they had Atung Baby out. Before Atung Baby came out, they played this gig and they'd been in Berlin recording and they'd seen the Berlin Wall and they'd seen all the... Maybe the wall had come down by then, but they'd see all these Trabants. And they had Trabants, which were the tiny Russian cars, but hardly any bigger or different in design from Dinky Toys. And they had them hanging from the roof. And they'd got very colourful and got great films. And they'd really come out refreshed. I think they were going to break up. That was the impression I got from spending quite a bit of time with them not long after that. And out of that conflict, they created this great record. So it was U2, Public Enemy, Kraftwerk, and Big Audio Dynamite.
Wow.
So basically, you know, Mick Jones, who was, the, you know, the Clash with Joe and the other two. And it was a brilliant gig and it drew everyone out. So there was an unusual situation backstage where there were all the young Manchester bands like the Happy Mondays, the Inspiral Carpets, the Stone Roses, and loads of other people on that scene. You'd spend a lot of time there. You'd meet the guys who were managing the bands or the photographers, or whatever. So there was DJs. There was a big scene of like young music bands. And there were the older music bands who were mates with U2. And that looked like a Q cover. So there were people like, you know, people from the Pretenders or R.E.M. They were kind of like more mature artists. Yeah. And there was, but then there was also this amazing array of footballers. It was like Kevin Moran, Kenny Dalglish, John Barnes, John Aldridge, Lee Chapman. I mean, real top. I mean, you just didn't, Ian Rush. I remember watching from the side through the bleachers, as you know, they call them in America. Mark Hughes was in front of me. We were watching from the side. He backed all, it was really weird. He backed all the way up. There was no one else there. He backed all the way up until he came about 10 feet to me, just stood on my feet. And then he went down.
took a dive.
No, but it was so in the middle of all this, the guy called Pete Wiley, who was in a legendary Liverpool band called Wah, and I were chatting, and somebody goes, "Bloody hell, look, there's Lou Reed." And Wiley goes, "Never mind that, there's Peter Reed." And literally all of this huge crowd of guys, about 20 of us, just marched over where Reedy was sitting and started talking to him. And because he'd obviously been a Man City, you know, a popular Man City player after his Everton career, and he'd been a popular player of England. You always got a feel that Peter Reid was like a sort of a man of the people.
Yeah.
You know, and I can remember sitting there. It was like a primary school or a nursery school class. He was sitting on a chair like this. People sitting on the floor. And he's looking back to it. You know, he'd be going, oh, I think what Kevin Ratcliffe is. Like, you know, when Tony Adams got into the team, it was like Jack and Ori with kids in the room. And I actually, for ages, I thought that was the start of what happened in the 90s. That moment for me when you just had this mixture. And I think also those bands, you know, those bands like the Charlatans, the Mondays and so on, they were all the same age as me. So that was great being a music writer. Yeah. You know, it's just suddenly they were like your mates. You know, they weren't people I'd looked up to. So there was a lot more commonality in. And, you know, we'd all grown up playing football and watching, you know, footballers, you know, when we could, going to the grounds or whatever. So it was a great moment.
The moment the football music really come together, I thought, you know, New Order doing the Italian 90 song. Yeah. But are New Order actually football fans? How did that happen? And did Keith Allen play a massive role, actually, in some of this?
Well, I've spent quite a lot of time with them. And I think Hookie, I mean, I remember being at Old Trafford and Hookie had, I think, so chosen the songs that were being played beforehand. And there was an interview with him in the programme. So I think, but when I was with them, I wasn't hearing a lot about football.
Yeah.
I mean, what I've heard over the years is four or five different people in the music business claiming to have originated that idea. But I guess it was just a collective. I think the thing was, I think that song existed. The music to that song existed. So it took it away of the thinking, how do we get 20 blokes to sing along? They just had the music. And then they had somebody who was into football, keeps like a big Fulham fan, who, you know, understood football, so he could write a song about it rather than, often they were songs that seemed to be defined to just have gangs of defenders chanting.
Yeah.
Singing along, which isn't really a good starting point.
After, so kind of when that football and music and culture and they all kind of come together in the 90s, obviously you go on and you go from the Enemy to founding Loaded.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of defining magazine of the era. And football was central to the pitch, right? Or your idea of what the kind of atmosphere of the magazine would be. Is that right?
Totally. Totally. I basically just wanted to get into football for free. That was an underlying factor. And the first guy I appointed on the magazine was Tim, who became the assistant editor. And I chose him because he was into the Jam and he supported Leeds. So he could have understood that mass audience. Yeah. Yeah. And then on the first thing I ever wrote down as a story idea after drinking was bald footballers. So it was sort of a nostalgia in the same way we're talking about the 90s.
Yeah.
That is my memory of those cards.
Yeah.
These really, really old looking men like, you know, Ralph Hennessy of Spurs and Bobby Charlton and, you know, they had the hair kind of
over. We've talked about the Bobby Charlton comb over before, and what I'd be interested in your theory on this is that as the top gets thinner, over the years, but the sides remain as strong. So why is the top getting thinner?
That's called male pattern baldness.
But no, the top is totally thin, but the comb over is getting smaller and smaller. Like he's trying to.
Just, you know, you've got, how old are you?
I'm 39.
Okay, give it 8 or 9 years. The answer will present itself in the morning.
Would you go with the Bobby Charlton comb over as a kind of...
No, definitely not. It's not long enough now.
So you wrote down bald footballers and football nostalgia. Also, did you say... Did I read in the book that you said that you went to a Barcelona away day and you basically said, this is what I want the magazine to be?
Yes, I don't know if you remember, but Leeds were able to replay a game at a neutral venue that had been... The result had been cancelled because Stuttgart, we played Stuttgart in Germany, but they'd come to Elland Road and they'd won on goal difference or something like that. And then just near the end, like one of the officials realised that they'd played a fourth foreign player or something.
Oh, yeah, when they had the three foreigners.
It'd been a kind of
Yeah.
A rule broken. So they changed the replay. Not, it should have just been at Leeds again, or I guess they should have just given us the result. And it was in Camp Nou in Barcelona. And Tim and I went out, and it was great. It was like that huge stadium with 2,000 or 3,000 Leeds fans at one end and a similar amount of Stuttgart fans at the other end. And just before kickoff, these Spanish came in and said something like, they had a massive banner, but it says something like, Barca v. Germany. Barca hates Germans. There was something that made it really clear. And there was a big cheer. There was a great atmosphere. And Leeds won. And just off the Ramblers that night, me and my mate, we met a fireman from Preston and a pipe fitter from Colchester. And the four of us were just hanging out in the bars. And I remember one bit being in a great bar and the next minute looking at a beautiful church. And then we blagged into a nightclub. I convinced them that we were the pop group, The Farm, which was always easy to do because The Farm were one of the first bands who didn't look like pop stars. They just like people, everyday people. And so I turned to Tim and said, this is what this feeling that we've got tonight is what the magazine should be like having a brilliant night. And I think football has that thing that it doesn't matter if you've been to Oxford and Cambridge or whether you've never been to university, whether you've been rich, whether you're poor, whether you're whatever race or sexuality you are, you can enjoy watching men and women booting a ball around on the pitch. It doesn't matter where you're from. And I guess that's my point, was that magazines before Loaded had been defined. Well, you had to be a cool guy to read The Face, or you had to be a really smart guy to read GQ. And that was the reason they didn't sell many copies, because they were saying only certain people can read these magazines. Yeah. And I kind of wanted Loaded to be all inclusive. And from the very off, the first thing I'd ever written was said it would have old legendary people interviewed who were knackered and past it, with brilliant stories to tell, a bit like me today.
It's gone full circle.
And cool and young up and coming people with attitude, like, you know, like you two. And that combination, the idea was it would be for, you know, a very open house. And I think editorially, you know, we could have an interview with Carl Cox, the DJ, on one page, and an interview with Ozzy Osbourne, even before he got cool for his TV series, on another page. And the same with the footballers. You know, we could have legends from the 70s, like Chopper Harris from Chelsea, or Charlie George. And then on the next page, we'd have an interview with Steve Bull, you know, or Mike Sheeran. I mean, that was another thing that I deliberately did was...
Did Mike Sheeran make it into Loaded?
You know, what we did was the big features space would have like Fowler and McManaman.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Phil Babb, Gary Kelly and Jason McAteer talking about the World Cup in 94 for Ireland. But then we had a sports section at the back within the general mix of different things. We had a review section at the back. We'd always have a football interview in there. So it would be someone like Claridge or Sheeran.
Yeah.
Or Steve Ball. It was deliberate. We wanted to have players that were from the lower leagues, but the lower league legends, because I wanted it to be all inclusive. And I understood that all the nightclubs we covered shouldn't be in the center of London as things, you know, the cool style press had been. They should be in Newcastle or Newquay or Aberdeen or Aberystwyth. We can go all over the country, because post Acid House, there were brilliant clubs everywhere and raves. But it was the same with football, you know. I think Mike Sheeran scored 50 goals in what is now League One. He had a couple of amazing seasons, and I think he was with Stoke. So there were just good stories, and people like Claridge you see on television now. But back then, all those years ago, Phil Tufnell, Steve Claridge, Paul Merson, people who had problems with their life, whether it was drink or gambling or drugs or whatever, they were never allowed anywhere near the television.
Yeah.
Nowhere near. And so we just leapt on all those guys, because they're the ones you want to interview.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to interview boring sports people who had been poached.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
No, totally. It'd be a lot more difficult now to do that, I think, with like, because obviously the 90s footballers were a lot more open. One of the, like, if not the greatest 90s footballer, almost a cover star to Loaded issue one, was Eric Cantona. Is that right?
Well, we
so
wanted...
that's like, you're almost saying that that is the perfect person to brand this magazine.
Totally. And in fact, like about a decade ago, I got asked to try and rescue a project. They were, a company were trying to make a male Grazia.
Right.
And it wasn't getting anywhere. So I went in and we put Eric on the cover. I found it when I was going through my magazines. It was still applicable, you know. 10 years ago, he was still a kind of semi-mysterious figure before he became a... I mean, he's almost become as prevalent as, you know, the kind of like the coffee advert people. You know, now he's on loads of ads. But back then, he was mysterious. And in the early 90s, when he arrived, he was... It was like what you said about that 90 World Cup that you know, nobody knew who Scalacci was. He was a sub. I think he got into the squad because maybe Rossi wasn't around or was out of form or something. And he was, Eric, nobody had heard of Eric Cantona in Britain. And he shows up. He was amazing at Leeds. And it was, I mean, he didn't win us the league as he's often referred to, but he was kind of just, it was a little bit like reinforcements arriving near the end.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was enigmatic. You know, they told... one of the stories I heard was that he used to go up... He had a shed on the moors in Otley and Ilkley, which is like 10 miles north of Leeds. Yeah. And he'd go up there and he had a motorbike and a shotgun and he would go hunting without a helmet with his bike. So you've got this almost Mad Max image of this guy with a shotgun on his back with a motorbike. And that the police would turn a blind eye to it because he was this... Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's the sort of story that was emanating about him. And so we just, you know, we said, let's put Eric on the first cover. But there were no photographs of footballers in those days. No photographs other than in kit.
Yeah.
They didn't... It was before John Terry got signed up by King of Shaves and everybody started doing branding. And... Yeah. They were just, we got three pictures of him. One was of him in double denim, hitchhiking. I don't know what it was. Another was in a Paco Rabanne cream suit on the catwalk. And another one was just looking miserable in a pub with having a pint with his agent. They were the only three pictures we could find for any of the agencies that didn't have him in a red shirt, which we obviously, as Leeds fans, we weren't going to do. So he was going to be the first cover, and then we just didn't have enough to put him on. We didn't have an interview. We got the guy who sometimes did press conferences for Man United to put all the clips together into a piece. And Man U kicked off about that when it was a feature.
Oh, so they just kind of botched together a kind of...
Yeah, it was just it's called a cuttings job. People often do that with film stars and stuff like that. Yeah. If you're an editor, you recognise them. But But years later, I did meet Eric.
Oh, did you?
And it was quite... when Joe Strummer died, they organised a party for him, you know, memorial party, not after the funeral, but just a few months later. And it was at the White Cube Gallery that Jay Jopling, Damien Hirst's sort of manager or agent, owned. And it was an amazing turn. I was invited. There was so many of the punk legends and new wave heroes, and it was just absolutely amazing. And then afterwards, we went on to Cargo or somewhere in Shoreditch. And at about midnight, the doors flew open, and these five guys walked in. It was like a cowboy scene. Yeah. These guys walked in like that. And you thought, oh, my God, who's this? And they had sleeping bags under their arms. Straight up, they arrived with sleeping bags under their arms, like they were roughing it. It was Eric and his brothers and friends. And one of his friends was a French photographer called Richard Ajard, I think is how you pronounce his name. And he'd taken, you might have seen this picture, it's a brilliant photograph of Eric in Maori war paint.
I've not seen that.
I'd found them in a French-Spanish photography magazine called Photo. And I think he lived quite near Barcelona after he retired, which is not far from the part of France where he'd grown up. And he was in this amazing garden of sculptures with this war paint. And I put it on the cover of British GQ when I was the editor of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they walked in, everyone was like, fucking hell. And me and my mates went straight over to them. I was with, and there was another guy I didn't know. He was a Cockney red Man U hooligan called Faz. And then my mate Dean, who writes with Irving Welsh.
Yeah.
Who's from Bradford. And we just went over to him and introduced ourselves. And even the guy said, oh, I'm Richard. I said, are you the photographer? And he said, yeah. And I explained that I put him on the cover. And straight away went, Eric! And he caught Eric over and said, this is the guy who put you on the cover of GQ with that war paint. So I was like, wow, this is amazing. I've already spent 2 hours chatting with various members of people like, you know, the Undertones, Buzzcocks and UB40 or whoever at the Strummer event, the Pistols. And then Eric shows up. It was really late. They'd got the last plane from France. And then my mate got Eric in a headlock and started kissing him. It really ruined it. Eric and I were sitting down with this woman. We were just sitting down chatting and stuff. He was talking a little bit about Leeds, but he was very quiet, really. And my mate Bucky came over and Eric and just literally climbed on him and started kissing him and got him there. And Eric just went with the headlock like this.
Was he okay with it? Did he really kick off? Or
I can't imagine. I had to drag Bucky off. It was Paul Buck was a. He's a music agent. He was a Man U fan. It ruined the night. But Eric was fine with it. He just let him kiss him until we dragged him off. Then he disappeared.
You met loads of footballers from the 90s. I just want to touch on a few. An unlikely name I didn't expect to see in your book was Louis van Gaal.
The thing is, Josh, that's probably 5 or 6% of the amount of stories I could have filled. I tried to give typical stories, so I forget that I put them in. One of the best things about Loaded being a success was every month we basically got to go on holiday or a school trip. I had a credit card. Nobody was saying you can or can't do anything. So we would literally say, where should we go? And some guys would go surfing in Hawaii, and then somebody else would go bobsleighing in Switzerland, but the city breaks were popular.
Yeah.
Especially ones that had drugs on sale for free, you know, like legally.
Yeah.
So we went to Amsterdam and we took this dope cake. We were in the shop and I said, what does this do? And the lady goes, these three will have a nice time. These two will stop an elephant. Another drug addict tonight on the staff just grabbed them, necked them. And she was right. You know, there were no elephants in Amsterdam the night. But by the way, we went to watch Ajax versus, I think it was either Den Haag or William the 12th or whatever that team is called. And Ajax hammered them. It was like 6-1 or something. But by the time half time had passed, I was actually crawling around on the floor, barking and howling and just like a dog. And the good thing, and tears and laughing, and I was really fucked. I mean, lots of people have been there. You don't have to have been a magazine editor to have experienced that. And afterwards, they had the mixed zone then, which they do now. And they still have around the world. I was in Japan a couple of years ago and with my mate, and we were like talking to players in the mixed zone in Kobe. I think they have it in some clubs in England now, but in Holland it was a big thing. And we had press passes. I was quite a prolific liar in those days. I'm not now. The book is, there's no dishonesty in the book at all. And I went up to Louis van Gaal, still tripping, and asked him when the Mark Overmars to Man United deal was going to be finished, like it was just a done deal. This was obviously before Overmars joined Arsenal a few years later when Wenger showed up. But and Louis, he was so vociferous that this wasn't happening, because obviously it wasn't.
Yeah.
That it sounded like he was protesting too much. And the Dutch journalists, particularly the Ajax supporting journalists, started getting really worried. And and I told them I was from the Mirror or the Sun or somewhere, you know, British tabloid sports. We were covering, they'd been told by Man United it was happening. And all I could see was his head glistening, getting angrier and angrier and sweatier and sweatier. Especially my mates dragged me out. And it was just about, you know, we kind of had access to a world through the magazine that players wanted to be in it, or you'd see them at the sort of bars you'd go to, or they'd take you out, or they'd come to our parties, or you'd bump into them on drugs in a meat zone. In a...
Did you hang out with the Ireland team as well quite a lot?
Just after Loaded started, we went to the shoot, because we kind of shared some... well, actually, we didn't share, because we used the shoot photo library a lot for the nostalgia pictures. Yeah. There's a guy there, Duncan. He was great. I used to love going in there. I mean,
I bet that was a great...
This is pre-digital. It was just... Yeah. It was like long, metal, huge cabinets, and you kind of do a wheel. It's like something from a submarine. These doors would open, you'd go down, and there were just thousands of drop-down hanging cardboard envelopes. And it'd say something like, you know, Birmingham City, 1970s. And you pull it out, and there'd be these great shots of Andy Gray and Bob Latchford with massive, not even mullets, because they were long everywhere.
Yeah.
I used to, when I was in development on the magazine, I used to go up there a lot. And the shoot invited us to the Goal of the Year awards.
Oh, wow. Who knew that
existed? Well, it might even have been the Golden Boot. It might have been the Division One shoot-sponsored Golden Boot.
Yeah.
Where are they hosting that?
Old Trafford, unfortunately. Tim and I took marker pens and did a few of the backs of the posters, you know, the backs of the, which I like doing. I've done that at a few grounds when I've been in areas that wouldn't expect vandalism. You're having the Sky Sports box at Chelsea, take the pictures off, you'll see a few leads. And at that shoot, Goal of the Year, we met McAteer and the centre-back who played for Bolton. And
Alan Stubbs. Alan Stubbs. Yeah.
So Alan Stubbs and McAteer, we had a really good laugh. We had just had a really good night. They liked the magazine. And they got in touch with us. We rang the office. And Jason said, look, we've got these Irish football awards. I had such a good laugh. Do you want to come? So Tim, the assistant editor, and I got in a car, went on a ferry, showed up on the border. It was a Sunday night. And the Republic were playing the North on a Wednesday night in a World Cup qualifier. So they were staying just south of the border with the North in this country house hotel. And we got there, and it was more like being with a band than a football team. Roy Keane was at the bar with Niall Quinn. Keane, as I put in the book, you couldn't tell whether he was just quite a modest young man then. It was an early sign of the madness, and we love and now enjoy curious analysis. But I remember him going to bed at like 10 to 11. We got there about 10:30, went straight to the bar, checked into the hotel. And he said, as he was going out the door, he said, no, Niall's a much better player than me. So we went out, and Niall Quinn stayed up as a senior player drinking with his other guests. About 9:15, Charlton, the manager, is wandering around looking furious, hunting for players who he'd heard weren't in. 11:30, Babsy, McAteer, and a few of the others come pelting in. I mean, sprinting to get there for the curfew. And they got in, and we saw Phil, and he just said, what room are you in? I said, 12 or whatever. He said, all right, I'll see you there in 30 minutes. I'll see you there in 10 minutes. So he went off and went to bed. Everybody was waiting for Gary Kelly. And eventually I got hold of one of the FAI guys who didn't look like, he looked like he was closer to the players than Jack. And he said, no, they're all in now. They're all in there. But we knew Kells hadn't come in. So when we got in the room with Babsy I said, where is he? He said, oh, he's led him on a wrecking crew. He won't be back for hours. He's just surrounded by people in the pub, because he really was.
Yeah.
He was one of the few guys in that team who were actually from Ireland.
Yeah, yeah.
Second generation. They weren't London with Irish parents like Andy Townsend or Cascarino. No parents, you know, no Irish blood. I don't think he was there then. But the and we sat up till about 2 or 3 in the morning drinking with Babsy. And he told us the most amazing stories. And it was like reading the book about Led Zeppelin. Just chaos. No drugs, but all this. He joined Liverpool by then, and he was shocked at all the groupies that Liverpool had. And next morning we got up, they went out to train. I said, how are you going to train? He said, I'm going to bin bag it. I said, what's that? He said, we can play it, wear a plastic, you know, like a bin bag, a black bag under the shirt, and it sweats all the alcohol out.
Wow.
They went out to train at 9:30 the next morning. We had a quick chat, met Gary and Kells and Jason McAteer. 20 minutes later, they were back in. I said, what are you doing? He said, Jack don't fancy it. He said, let's go and get another bacon sandwich. So they were like, it's easier to access footballers now because of Instagram and Twitter and things. And they've all got commercial deals, so you get a lot more opportunities to interview them. But in those days, there were no phones. There was no taking photographs. Yeah. Of an Irish fullback sitting in a bar surrounded by people he probably shouldn't have been surrounded by at 1:30 a.m. on a Sunday night.
Did you go out with the Spice Boys kind of Liverpool team then as well? From like, you know, Babs?
Yeah, a few times. Team. Yeah, they came to some of our events, and then a couple of times when Jason or Jamie Redknapp, you know, these boys would all be in the magazine. They like being in Loaded.
Did a lot of the footballers read Loaded then?
Yeah, absolutely. There's none of this.
Yeah.
None of this and headphones and locking themselves in. They were just sitting around on coaches like any football team. That's what was interesting. They were like any football team going on an away game. They would be sitting on coaches. And in the run-up to Euro 96, England were training at Burnham Beaches or somewhere. And I thought, well, I'll send them some magazines. I've been there once with a friend who lived nearby in Marlow. I thought, well, I'll just send a box of them and they'll get there. And we used to have this thing called Platinum Rogues, which was the Premier League of bad behaviour. And they usually were just people either getting away with things or being an arse or funny stories of things that had gone wrong with famous people or people who weren't famous but funny. I sent this box over. I think Gazza was on the cover, which was why I sent it. And I was in Terry Venables' nightclub, which in itself sounds strange. You know?
What were Scribes like? I always imagined
it. It was just a glossy. It was more like a bar than a night. Yeah. You know, it was kind of like a bar and a kind of stage. He loved doing karaoke.
So would you see Venables doing karaoke in there?
Yeah, well, loads of them.
What kind of songs he doing?
It's got to be My Way and stuff, right?
Obviously, Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, right. Obviously.
Kenny Sheringham would be in there. And I think it was a 90 Minutes magazine, or maybe when they launched Goal. 90 Minutes and Goal were ran from the office right next door through the wall from mine at Loaded. And we went over there and I'd sent these magazines. I didn't know if they would get to them. And I was in the toilets and Terry came in. And it all went quiet. And I came out of the toilet cubicle I was in. And the guy, all these guys kind of went, oh, Terry, this is James. He does Loaded. Have you heard of it? He goes, of course I've heard of it. I can't get it out of the players' hands when I'm doing my talks. But the thing, the reason I mentioned Premier, the bad behaviour chart, the Platinum Rose was, it was only after I sent it that I realised about 5 of the players were in it for different things.
Really?
I never thought. But it was the perfect magazine for anybody who was trapped anywhere, you know, like if you were in the army and you had a lot of sitting around, or you had a job where you were, you know, sitting around, or anyone who's traveling a lot, you know, but not driving, you know, people who are spending time on trains. And, you know, and Bob Mortimer called me one day, said, oh, I love the latest issue. He said, it's at least an hour's read. I was really put out, you know. It take 30 days to produce this thing. I said, oh, come on, man. There's a lot more. I goes, listen, Brownie, that's what he called me, like my mates from home.
Yeah.
He said, an hour's a great, it's a good time. It's a long time to stick with a magazine. If you're a reader, which I never thought about, because we produced every word on every page.
Yeah. Gazza was obviously a out with Cantona for the most iconic. He was a cover star as well of Loaded, right? How do you go? Is it easy to get Gazza to be on
it
the
was
cover?
So hard to get football interviews in those days. So when I did Merson, I had to pay him 500 quid. So that was it. You'd pay them money. They weren't particularly good interviewees. Gazza, however, is gold. And one of the staff, a guy called Adam Black, one of the Loaded staff, he still is a table tennis coach and player.
Yeah.
He said to me one day, he said, this weekend I was with Gazza's agent, Mel Steen. I was teaching his son. I said, can you get an interview? He went, oh, yeah, I'm football. So that's how we got the interview, because Adam coached, but there was a requirement. Gazza said he didn't want any money, but could we get him some videos for his stepson? So we called HMC.
What kind of videos?
Bugsy Malone and stuff like that. Yeah. This is like a video. What? There's no DVD.
Just want some films on VHS.
Yeah. Yeah, some new films, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, you know, whatever, kids' films. So we called HMV and said, look, can we get some films for Gazza and we'll say thanks to HMV at the end? They said, yeah. So one of the staff went around and bought 50, I mean, remember how thick videos were? They were massive. And then we got them sent up to Gazza, and then John Wilde, pre-season, who was our lead interviewer, he went out to Scandinavia I think he'd moved to Rangers by this point. They were doing a pre-season tour. And John was waiting in the reception and he got a text to whoever the contact was, you know, and Gazza came out and he said, are you Loaded? He goes, yeah. He said, come here. And he took him in. He took John into where all the players were and goes, this is the guy that's getting me the videos. The guy's getting the videos for Regan. He's getting, everyone's getting all these videos. He was going to believe it. And it was slightly delayed. And I remember ringing the office complaining. But then he got there and he was absolutely delighted. So 50 videos was the Gazza. It was a good interview as well and good photographs. He had bleach blonde. I think that was the cover, either just before or just after 96, whenever he joined Rangers.
Did you, and you met him yourself, presumably, at some point as well, right? You get these interviews and you're like, I have to send someone else out to meet Paul Gascoigne. I'd love to do that myself, but you...
I was at a party once at Pinewood Studios and Gazza was there. I think that was a Pet Shop Boys party and that's when he was knackered from Lazio after the Gary Charles tackle and I remember he was sitting there in a shell suit and this big, a case on his leg. And I think, I can't remember where else I've seen him, but I did meet him years later.
Yeah.
It was really... Often people ask me, you know, what was the most Loaded moment? And it was years after I was interviewing Liam Gallagher for a music magazine. And my mate texted me, he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm interviewing Liam Gallagher. He said, I'm with Gazza at the Groucho Club, which is a well-known media haunt. And I said to Liam, we just finished. I said, do you want to go and meet Gazza? And he went, yeah. But Liam was not allowed in the Groucho because he got drunk and thrown some snooker balls around and smashed the top snooker room up. So I had to vouch for him. I said, James, he can come in. He didn't think there'd be any problem. It was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We got upstairs and Gazza was pretty drunk and he'd had quite a lot of Sambucas and he wasn't supposed to be drinking. We arrived, there were all these empty Sambuca glasses and loads of Haribo everywhere. And I said to my mate, Dan, I thought he wasn't drinking. And he said, that's why he's got the Haribo. And I said, because when I stop drinking, you start eating loads of sugar because of all the sugar and alcohol.
Right,
he craves it. And so Gazza was on, I don't know how he'd gone from the Haribo to, you know, the Tangfastics to the Sambucas with remember there was never coffee bean in them? And he was knocking shots back. And he insisted on Liam singing. And it was, go on, man, go on, sing us, go on, live forever. You know, it was like, kind of, Liam was getting quite narked. Eventually, I knew that Liam had a son the same age as mine. So I just started singing the SpongeBob SquarePants theme. Oh, he lives in a pineapple under the sea. And Liam stood up and went, SpongeBob SquarePants. finished the theme tune. Gazza was delighted. Because it got to the point where Liam was going, I'm not asking you to keep the ball in the air and Joe do some headers. Gazza told the most insane stories that afternoon. He told us about, he briefly dated Liz Hurley. He told us he'd been arrested, not arrested, but like held back by security for shoplifting. He told us just, I mean, there was 5 or 6 of us sitting there listening to him. That was in Spain, and he got off because one of the guys had recognised him from Lazio, and it was nuts. It was absolutely nuts. But I love him. I mean, I hope he's okay. It's not, I wouldn't want to, Gazza's, you know, like George Best, you don't want to glorify the drink. And he's not a great guy because he drank a lot by any means.
Yeah.
He's just, as a personality, when he's sober and together, he's very entertaining. But obviously, when the drink takes over, he's not in a good place. And he was great. But he reminded me of, remember that fast show character, Unlucky Alf?
Yeah.
Always getting electrocuted. And
every anecdote ended with, you could hear him go, oh, bugger. Anyway, Liam and I had to go and get our kids. At 45 minutes later, we had to go and get the kids to pick them up from school at 3:15. And I'm down the steps, halfway out of the club, and he just goes, hang on a minute. And he just ran back upstairs. And I heard this, and all he's screaming like, no, Liam, no. And he'd gone back and got the fire extinguisher, just let it off all over. And he said, by that point, I just kept walking, and Liam kept running out. He said, run! He stopped in the next street. I didn't even, wasn't even beyond Soho Square when the phone went and said, James, he's barred. you're paying for the fire extinguisher.
One thing that I kind of loved about Loaded, you get these fold-out posters that were half of, there was one where it was like, I can't remember the model, but it'd be a model on one side, then it'd be a footballer on the other. So it'd be like, you'd get like Sophie Anderton and Kenny Dalglish were your poster options.
Yeah, or the one I put on yesterday on Instagram was, which is at James Brown, if you want any more of this. Cindy Crawford on one side and a painting of a steam train on the other. You've got to realise we were just, you know, essentially we were just young guys dicking about. We were doing things that, you know, you ever with your mates on holiday or something where you spend a lot of time and you go beyond the normal things and you start doing stupid things. It was like that every day. There were no adults. I just thought it'd be funny if we start putting really kind of strange things, because we started off, as you've just said, we'd put kind of hot woman that we knew the readers would like one side, and maybe Kenny Dalglish or George Best or The Clash, you know, our heroes on the other side. So it worked. You know, if you like the culture, if you like the girls, you know, you could choose what you put up. But after a while, I started putting things like fish and chips or just a posting shot of fish and chips or a bacon sandwich or, you know, battleship. I started thinking about this. I don't know. A place that hasn't been totally revolutionised and modernised yet is the greeting card stand.
Yeah.
You can still find quite weird interpretations and deliveries of what men are into.
Yeah.
You go into a newsagent's, especially in a smaller town or kind of newsagent that's not been modernised, maybe it's still got something as quaint and weird as magazines still in it.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there'd be happy birthday, Grandpa. There'd be a bit kind of weird painting of a guy fishing.
Yeah.
happy birthday, son. 9 today. There'd be a picture of 3 guys in indeterminate football kits all chasing a ball that isn't actually on the painting. So that's where I was going with that. I said, why don't we start doing posters of things like that? And like the Airfix model paintings on the front. Yeah. It was just nostalgia, you know. It was like,
One of the ways the Loaded kind of used the footballing vernacular was you have stuff like the Crisp World Cup and stuff.
Yes.
Obviously now has become such a kind of format But like, that was the first time you saw that. Do you remember who won the CRISP World Cup?
Absolutely. I was in my office and...
How was it decided? Were you all genuinely taking it quite seriously?
The one thing I remembered from science lessons at school, which I didn't do very well in any lessons, never mind science, was that if you do an experiment, it's got to be under controlled circumstances. Yeah. So I said, we've got to do this properly. So we bought something like 64 bags of crisps, which in 1995 or 1994 was very hard to do. Yeah. So we had things like Apple Rings. There weren't things like Tesco and Sainsbury's locals where you could get endless bags of crisps. One of the boys was out for hours trying to get 64 bags of crisps, and they didn't have jumbo packs then. None of that. They were just individual. So we decided we'd have one crisp each, and we'd have 64, take it down to like 32, take that 16, 8, 4. And but obviously by the end of it, we were like, we were just all out of crisps. We were all out of crisps. And the other weird thing was we were speeding. You eat that many crisps. We were there for hours doing this. It was just before we finished the issue, which was why it was so small in the mag. And at the very end, we couldn't decide on the last two. Somebody said, let's call the Pope. So this is true. Yeah. We rang the Vatican. And you would imagine that an Italian would answer the phone, and it was an Irish guy. And the guy just was laughing. And our guy, whoever was on the phone, was in my little office. And they were like, I said, oh, really? He said, okay, put the phone on. He says, an Irish priest, he says, he's a hula hoops man. And then after that, after we knocked them all, when the Pope couldn't decide, we just decided we had no more crisps left, so we would call the companies.
Yeah.
And we couldn't call the companies, so we rang cab offices in each of the towns that the crisps were producing. One was in America, one was in Leicester, and we decided which... ever city was cheaper to get to the airport in a cab. And that's how it was decided.
Amazing.
But after that, it was so popular, that feature, that we did vodka, breakfast cereals, pretty much all sorts of stuff. It became a template. And, you know, as years have gone by, other people have used that.
One from Michael quickly is, you wrote for the Leeds United magazine.
Yeah.
What was that like as an experience? Did you get to meet all your kind of heroes in that situation?
Well, they weren't my heroes. They were just the great players of the day. What happened was, when I was in 1998, I stopped drinking, and because I had to, really. It wasn't getting any better at it. I hadn't found a way to put a plug in it each day. And then... I suddenly had hours. I mean, really, between 6 o'clock and midnight were, and indeed every lunchtime, every afternoon, were just suddenly so much time to do stuff. So I noticed that the Leeds mag, official mag, was done in Manchester, and it wasn't very good. And it was maybe it was even closing or something. So I had a mate who was Gary Speed and David Batty's agent.
Yeah.
And I said, see, the club want me to do a mag for them in my spare time, and I'll get loads of really good writers and photographers and designers who all support Leeds. So they came back. They were delighted. It was some new guys had just owned it. But what I didn't know was they were running Leeds from Argyle Street, which is down from Oxford Street.
Yeah.
And the chairman had an office in Argyle Street.
Oh, wow.
So we set up in his office. So I'd bomb over at lunchtime from GQ and after work, and we set this magazine up. And it became really popular. But the problem was it was a fan, sort of a fans and family-friendly magazine. And I had a lot of guys who were used to writing for magazines like Loaded. So when Billy Bremner died, for instance, I called Irving Welsh and said, Irv, can you write a tribute? He said, no problem. So the words come in, you don't fuck around with someone like Irving Welsh's copy. You just walk in and it was like, oh, you're a fucking genius, you're a fucking hell, he's fucking, you know, and he was just swearing like how he writes. And there were complaints about that, not from the club. They thought it was great. There were young guys who bought the club. There were guys in their early 30s that floated on the stock exchange. But then we start, and we just had total freedom, and it was absolutely brilliant. It was basically an official fanzine, really. But we had great access. So we'd have people who were shooting pictures for GQ shooting Alan Smith or David Batty or, you know, Lucas Radobi. And it was really popular. It was a really good thing. But at one point, we had a column called, I can't remember if it was called True or False, or whether we just did You'll Never Believe It or something like that. And me and this guy, Les Rowley, who was a comedy writer, we used to just sit and write, like make stuff up. So like, you know, the cheese is full of goalposts or the centre circle's got an old well beneath it and stuff that you can't maybe. Most football grounds have some strange legend about them.
Yeah.
And, you know, but we had 24 strange legends every day. And like one of them was that I put in, I remember putting in that Ian Hart couldn't read. And the way he was looking at me after that came out in the players' lounge at Nottingham Forest away, he obviously could read. He was just scowling at us. You know, Ollie, who was the designer, and I, we're going to Brighton on Saturday. We used, you know, we'd be going away to a lot of matches. And then another thing we did was, do you remember David Miller used to present 606?
Yeah, yeah.
I think the BBC wanted to be in with the government a bit. He was Chelsea fan who literally the second or third issue. This I'm listening to this at home. That's the thing with radio. You don't know what's coming. And he goes, oh, I've got a listener now. It's Maureen from Beeston in Leeds. And she's very upset about the new Leeds United magazine. Oh, I've got a copy of it here. And this lady's on the phone going, my son gets this, it's full of swearing, it's terrible. And David Miller starts reading these things out, like Tony Yeboah's arse had been used as a template for the Ghanaian skateboard park. And it was like, it was nuts. It was just, I mean, literally, there were six or seven of us in his tiny office in just off Regent Street, just like banging it out. And when George Graham left, this guy called Mark Waits, who's got a massive ad agency now called Mother, they're like one of the biggest ad agencies in Britain. And Mark said, why don't we do a toilet sticker with George's face on it and then put underneath it, he shat on us, now you can shit on him forever. And we'll make it waterproof and you can stick it in your toilet. So we put that in the mag, in the official club mag. And I was away, Leeds were in the UEFA League, UEFA Cup at the time, and Peter Ridsdale came up to me and he said, I can't be seen to approve of this public, but well done with that sticker. It was a brilliant time to be close around the club, and it was obviously an even better time if you were a fan or a player, because O'Leary really got that mix of some really good buys.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Bridges was a fantastic player. Olivier Dacour. You know, we had some good, really, really good.
It was a great team. Do you feel like O'Leary was kind of, it's kind of, he's been forgotten a bit because he went to Aston Villa, it didn't really work out. He did good job there, didn't he?
It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. George Graham was trying to buy Alan Thompson. He had Bruno Ribeiro as left midfielder, who was a pretty, not a bad sort of left-sided midfielder. Mm. And he wanted Thompson. And if he bought Thompson, Harry Kewell wouldn't have come through. He wouldn't have got anywhere near the first team. And Kewell had played. I'd seen him come on once as a kid with Howard Wilkinson at Elland Road. And Wilco had dropped in a couple of those players. You know, I remember seeing Ian Hart very early on at Highbury and just thinking, God, this guy's not going to make it. He's going to get skinned, you know.
Yeah.
Humberg or somebody was just leaving him for dead. And but from the off, as soon as O'Leary got in, he put McPhail and Woodgate in. McPhail had a really good career, more in the Championship with Barnsley and Cardiff, but he was a really good player. He was really skillful. He reminded me of Liam Brady, the way he used to play. But, of course, the more famous ones like Smithy, it was just from the off. I know that O'Leary told me that Tony Adams had called him and said, you better tell that kid to calm down, someone's going to hurt him. Because you probably won't, I mean, maybe you will remember this, but it was like he was an assassin. He just literally, every game for Alan Smith's first 10 games or so, he just takes someone out. Peter Shaw, Tony Adams, I mean, like legends of the game. This kid, and he didn't drink, Alan Smith. I hosted a fashion show that he modelled in once. We were both sitting sober, everyone else having champagne. We were chatting, and he was a really nice, quiet guy, and it was really really bad the way he himself is perceived, because he didn't have any choice in that sale. He was told, if you don't go to Man United, Leeds is going to go bust, you know. And then he was advised not to come to Lucasford Davies' testimonial and play in it by the police.
Bloody hell.
The people, having been around the club when, you know, before that, still having contacts there, you wish the fans could get the full stories, because he was a great player for us and a really good guy, you know.
James, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much. We didn't really get onto the Leeds as much as so much loaded chat. The book Animal House it'll be out now by the time this goes out. It's so good. Thank you so much for your time, James. It's been an absolute
pleasure. It's been great. I've really enjoyed it.
We always end, James, with one final question, which is that if I gave you the option to go back in time to the 1st of January 1990 and relive the decade again, would you take that option?
Jesus, again.
You had quite a busy one. It did sound quite hard.
I barely got out of that decade alive.
You know? You don't want to roll the dice.
I've got to tell you something. For all the great stories in the book, I don't hanker after it. I mean, I was fucking knackered by the end of that decade.
But while you're ahead.
So actually, probably no.
No.
Wow.
Yes, but I can't. Yeah. You know, the idea of that even happening just makes me think. I don't think I would. I was really lucky to stop drinking.
You joined Gary Neville and said no.
Yeah, enjoys chocolate.
You know what as well? I think just, you know, as somebody who's 20 years older than you two, when you have a brilliant time, so long as you take the best things from it and move forward, if you're sitting there thinking, I wish I could do that again, it's not the right way to move forward.
No.
You're stuck in the past if you do that. And I had like a nice life then. And it's quite weird for me to be revisiting all of this stuff. I'm enjoying it. So I really enjoy talking about the football.
Oh, thanks, man. Cheers, James. It's been absolutely
cheers,
James.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Thanks, mate. There we go. And James Brown's book, Animal House, is available to buy now. I would say it has got more killer anecdotes in it than any book I've read since Steve Bruce's Striker. I'd say that. Now, shall we end with a quiz, guys?
Let's do it.
Yeah, why not?
In honour of Leeds United, you will remember in 1993, Leeds United played Rangers in what was dubbed the Battle of Britain as they met in the European Cup. I would like a game of starting 11 played with the first leg of that match. Rangers won 2-1. Play starting 11, you can have one wrong. The second one you get wrong, you are out. Would you like to begin the game, Michael?
I will go for my favourite player of all time, Eric Cantona.
Correct.
Oh, yeah, good one. I'm going to go John Lukic.
Correct.
Gary McAllister.
Correct.
Andy Gorham.
Correct.
Gary Speed.
Correct.
Ali McCoist.
Correct.
Tony DiRigo.
Correct.
Now I'm getting desperate.
Yeah, I've got nothing from Rangers now. You took my two.
I've got two answers and one is a gamble.
Okay.
They're both gambles, really. I'm going to go with Mark Hatley.
Correct. Mark Hatley's got a very interesting career. I was reading about him the other day. He's researching some interview we're doing or something, not with Mark Hatley. And I did think, I didn't really know much about Mark Hatley because he was just a bloke who played for Rangers. But if anyone knows Mark Hatley, I'd love to interview him.
Yeah. Was he in Milan?
I played for Milan, he played for England in World Cups. He then played for Monaco, played for Rangers. Then he managed Hull.
Did he invent the Predator?
Invent the Predator. Craig Johnson invented the Predator.
Oh, that's who I'm thinking of, yeah.
Yeah.
If you know Craig Johnson, please get in touch.
I'd love to interview him about the Predator. Let's not let that distract.
Question one, is it all a load of nonsense?
Yeah. Well, do you know what we should do? Someone sent it to us. The next time we do a watch-along, either for Fan Club or Normal, someone sent us the documentary about Craig Johnson inventing the Predator, which I cannot wait to watch. I remember watching it at the time. It just involved him sticking a bit of ping pong bat onto his boot Anyway, Michael, carry on.
Yes, I remember that. I do remember that.
I'm very grateful for the extra thinking time.
Oh, God.
Lee Chapman.
Correct. I'm going to have to use my other gamble, which was your friend and mine, Trevor Stevens.
Correct.
Oh,
it's always a shame if one of the people we've interviewed doesn't get chosen on.
I'm now out, I think.
There's two Leeds midfielders that are eminently gettable.
Yeah, okay. Okay, that's
the Leeds defence is... I'm going to say it. Not title-winning man for man. And there's some famous-ish Scottish players that you could possibly get, but it's a stretch. Whose go is it?
My go. I don't think I've got anyone from Rangers. I can just guess at a Scottish name, and as long as you don't press me on the first name.
Okay.
No, I've got a Leeds gamble, Rocastle.
Incorrect.
Do I have to get this right?
Who are you going for, Skull, to win it?
Danny Wallace?
Incorrect.
Oh!
I mean, I suppose we're now in a world where people just throw out names. The first one to get one right is the winner.
Well, the other one I was thinking of is...
Ferguson.
David Batty. Is that too early for Batty?
Well, okay. So they're your two guesses.
Yeah.
David Batty is correct. Incredibly, Rangers have a player called Ferguson. No one expected it. So, Michael, to continue the game, I'm going to need the first name of Ferguson.
Oh, come on.
Go with Tosh. Come on, be brave.
David Ferguson.
Oh, it was Ian Ferguson.
Oh,
so those teams, Andy Gorham, John Brown, Richard Goff, that was gettable, Dave McPherson, David Robertson, Ian Ferguson, Stuart McCall, Trevor Stephen, Ian Durant, Mark Haley, Ali McCoist. Leeds, John Lukic, you got that. Chris Fairclough and Chris White at centre-back. Tony Dorigo, you got. John Newsom, wouldn't have got that, would you?
No.
David Batty, Gary McAllister. This is one you could have got. Gordon Strachan. Gary Speed, Eric Cantona, Lee Chapman. How would you like to end the show, Chris?
That was good. Well, seeing as we had James Brown on, it's got to be loaded by Primal Scream, right?
Perfect. We will see you next week, or as Chris would say,
Stuart Slater, see you later.
Just what is it that you want to do?
We want to get loaded, and we want to have a good time.